Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. We have one of our perennial guests here and one of my favorite people in the world, Dr. Merrill Nask, who is a physician, a general practitioner who practices in Maine, although the Maine Medical Board has been trying to take her license and she's been making fools of them in her court case, which is really, by the way, one of the most enjoyable reads that I've had in years, the transcripts of that court case and the just the humiliating situation these so-called experts have gotten themselves into. Merrill's also one of the leading bioweapons research experts. She's testified repeatedly before Congress, I think like six occasions. She was one of the lead investigators who discovered key issues about the anthrax attacks and researchers on the anthrax attacks back in 2001. And of course, we know that that anthrax, which originally was blamed on Saddam Hussein, and it ended up coming from federal bioweapons facilities, probably the Fort Detrick. The FBI found that it came from Fort Detrick, which is the joint Army and CIA bioweapons facility in Maryland.
I have to correct you. The FBI never solved the case, never was able to show where it came from. And their
But they, I
theory of the
mean,
case got criticized.
they accused Bruce Ivins, who was
Yes.
the scientist in that lab, and then he allegedly committed suicide, and then they just dropped the case.
They dropped the case, and the GAO wrote a report, and the National Academy of Sciences issued a report afterwards that criticized the FBI's theory of the case. So they didn't exact so they dropped it because they didn't have to take it to court, but they cl still claimed in their Amerithrax report that Ivins had been the guilty party.
Right.
Ivins was a friend of mine.
I didn't know that. And what was the nature of that friendship?
We had sat next to each other in a conference on the ethics of biological defense work in 1991. And so we'd known each other for a long time, and I would attend anthrax conferences. He sometimes sent me articles. We'd hang out together at the conferences. He was a juggler. My son was a juggler, and I brought my son to one of the conferences. So anyway, he was a nice guy, and he did not do it.
Yeah. And the I think one of the lead investigators, the director of the lab for the FBI was, I'm trying to remember his name because he was on Fauci's NSABB. He was on his, internal board that approved gain of function research, and then he ended up playing some key roles in the pandemic.
There was a David Huxall, but that was before that, who was the commander at Fort Detrick in 1991.
All right, we'll move on. So, and Merrill, I wanted you to be on the show today for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'd like to just get a lot of people are worried about the WHO initiatives that would put WHO in charge of pandemic response globally, that they would actually be able to impinge on US sovereignty and on the management of our public health system once they declare a pandemic, and it would be up to them to declare the pandemic. And of course, we know that the director of science at WHO is Jeremy Farrar, now Sir Jeremy, who should be in a lot of trouble because his emails reveal that he was masterminding the cover-up of the COVID lab leak with Dr. Fauci and Francis Collins. And he was the scientist who fabricated the 2006 bird flu pandemic, which of course never happened, but the pharmaceutical industry made, I think, $20 billion on a vaccine that, of course, didn't work and there was no pandemic. But anyway, so tell us what's happening with the WHO right now. I'm just saying that because we don't really want that guy, Sir Jeremy, declaring pandemics when we know that he has a long record of declaring fake pandemics.
Yes, and I'll just say about Sir Jeremy Farrar that he was instrumental in the overdose trials of hydroxychloroquine. So he funded them, the WHO one. He was at the top of the heap deciding on those trials. And in the UK, he also helped fund that overdose trial. He is still
Just so
talking about
that our
bird
listeners
flu.
understand, so that our listeners understand that, at the beginning of the pandemic, it was a desperate need to discredit therapeutic drugs that were effective against COVID, and particularly hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin. And because the U.S. law said that they could not give an emergency use authorization, the federal government cannot give an emergency use authorization to any vaccine if there is an existing drug that has been approved for any purposes that is shown effective against the target disease. Oh, very early on, they knew that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin were both devastatingly effective against COVID. And they ramped up this crusade to discredit them as horse wormer, et cetera, so that they could come back with a report that said that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, two of the safest, most heavily utilized drugs in the history of the world, that suddenly they were dangerous. A drug that's been given to 1 billion people with fewer side effects reported than aspirin or, common over-the-counter drugs, but they suddenly discredited it as dangerous. And that's the way they did it.
Yes. And so he and others are trying to drum up, and successfully, fears about avian flu, bird flu again. And now they are culling mink and some other mammals in Finland, I believe. But in the U.S., the bird flu is widespread in the wild bird population. And USDA is requiring farmers to test for it. And if they find it, their whole flock has to be culled. So there have been something like 60 to 100 million chickens killed in the United States in a year because of this. But the avian flu mutated, so it's no longer dangerous to people. Most people don't have any symptoms when they get it. They got one person in England who had fatigue for 4 days. And on the basis of that, they're culling 100 million chickens and have got a bird flu vaccine for humans now, as well as developing bird flu vaccines for chickens. So that is an evolving story. It's potentially a very dangerous one.
Yeah. So in 2006, he was in Vietnam working for the Wellcome Trust. And he found a little girl who had gotten sick. She had a duck that had died, and she buried it, and then she dug it up again, and she became sick. And he raised an alarm that it was bird flu and that it would kill, I think he said it was going to kill 200 million people within a year. And they shut down, they did almost everything they did during COVID, and then the bird flu just never materialized.
And so not a single person in the U.S. has ever died of bird flu. There were supposedly, I think, less than 100 people in Southeast Asia that died of it. But of course, Jeremy Farrar was probably in charge of a lot of those tests. So, we don't know.
Yeah.
They had. He was working in
fabricating the swine flu in 2009, too.
Yes.
There's a whole series of these flus that they fabricated in the lead up to COVID, and they finally, they finally got it right, and they got everybody, convinced that, they also were funding gain of function studies in Wuhan to make sure that we would have a pandemic at some point.
Right. And other places as well, including the United States. Okay. So what's going on at the WHO and the UN? Is that the claim is that we did such a terrible job on COVID that it turned into a catastrophe. And if only the nations had worked together and cooperated and shared their vaccines, everything would have been fine. So therefore, we need to have a pandemic treaty, which has never been developed before. And the pandemic treaty is not even going to require a declaration of a pandemic. It's going to be in effect all the time. And it incentivizes gain of function research, encourages all the nations to perform it, directs all the nations to go out and collect potential pandemic pathogens, to be swabbing animals, humans, and wastewater. And when they find them, they are directed to share them globally. As Del Bigtree said, this is open source biological weapons. Yeah. That's the treaty. It's very crazy. It also,
Richard Ebright said, it's like looking for a gas leak with a lit match.
Exactly. There is nothing to recommend this. It's completely insane. maybe they aren't planning to put that in the final version of the treaty, but it's in the current version, which was written by the Bureau, the WHO Bureau staff. And this latest version was submitted on June 2nd. The international health regulations are something that was pre-existing, but the United States suggested amending them a couple of years ago. And so now all nations have been asked to submit potential new amendments to this existing treaty, and they have. And so these amendments do call for a declaration by the Director General of WHO. At the moment, there are no standards by which he would make a declaration of a pandemic, but he can also declare a potential pandemic. And the provisions of the international health regulations could be enforced before, during, and after a pandemic. Now, so what could he do? Well, according to the IHRs, he could tell nations what drugs they must use and what drugs they won't be allowed to use during one of these declared pandemics. He can instruct a nation to manufacture a drug or vaccine for another country and direct it to be sent there, or other materiel that are necessary. There is also a concept of One Health, which is something that started out as a benign idea that certain illnesses transmit between humans and animals, and therefore veterinarians and doctors should work together on those illnesses. But it was co-opted. It was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation starting in 2009. And subsequently, the whole concept, even though very poorly defined, so nobody really knows what it is, but animals, plants, waterways, and ecosystems have been added to humans and animals so that everything in the world is now within the purview of One Health. The National Defense Authorization Act, that is law now in the United States, passed last December, includes instructions for the U.S. government to obey. So there's a 17 or 18 page section within this omnibus bill on international pandemic preparedness and response. So it directs the U.S. government to basically follow the WHO and Gavi and the global biosecurity agenda, and to use the One Health approach, whatever it is, with problem solving, and to embed this One Health approach and pandemic planning into the fabric of government. So these issues are now the issue of how you're being directed to respond to a pandemic is being embedded in the legal framework in the EU, in the US, by the WHO and the UN. They're using terms like whole of government, whole of society, and health in all policies approach. I've taken that to mean that they are trying to use public health as the means to gain sovereignty over anything that these agencies or governments claim is health related.
Yeah. Well, let me just mention something. If they really were concerned with zoonotic pandemics, in other words, pandemics that jump from animals to humans, the first thing that they would do is shut down the wet markets globally, which is a minor economic molecule compared to what they did to us, 3 years ago. And they would shut down all factory farming because the place that is absolutely the most dangerous place on earth, if you're worried about pandemics, are factory farms where they're using subtherapeutic antibiotics. And so it's like and they're crowding these animals into these tiny, tiny spaces. They're food animals that are being shipped all over the world. And they're dosing them with just enough antibiotics to make them gain weight. What they found is if you dose an animal with antibiotics, it kills something in their gut biome, which makes them gain weight. But it's also a formula for developing antibiotic
multi-drug resistant bacteria.
Oh, if you really were just concerned about pandemics, that's what you would do. And of course, that's not something they're going to do because that's not their real concern. And by the way, the last time we had a real pandemic, it was the Spanish flu. So that's 100 years ago. And the Spanish flu, as it turns out, as Anthony Fauci showed in his 2008 paper, was not a virus. what was killing people with the Spanish flu, it wasn't flu at all. It was a bacteriological pneumonia and meningitis. And it could have been cured today because they didn't have antibiotics, right? But it could have been cured overnight. And so this idea that bacteria or that viruses are constantly jumping to human beings from the wild and causing pandemics is a myth that is utterly unsupported by history. And in fact, the number one guy in gain of function study, Ralph Barrick from the University of North Carolina, he's the guy almost certainly who is responsible for COVID-19, for the pandemic. If you had to show one guy who's probably responsible for it, is Ralph Barrick. You know, when they start suing people, his name is going to be at the top with Fauci, Barrick, Xi Jinping, and a couple of others. And they, I guarantee you, they are going to be named in a lawsuit for causing this pandemic. So Ralph Barrick wrote a paper in 2008, in which he was trying to convince the people to start investing in a new class of bioweapons using synthetic biology and some of his CRISPR technologies and his genomic engineering techniques. And what he says in that is really interesting, because he says in the preface that it's very, very hard to develop new bioweapons from existing creatures. Because number one, because the mutations that actually allow them to jump to humans are so rare in the wild, and you know, at the interface between where human beings are interacting with wilderness, with monkeys, et cetera, and that when they do jump, they quickly mutate into a benign form. Oh, they're very unstable. And they don't, you know, they don't want to kill people, because if you kill your host, you're killing yourself. And, you know, the ones that are most successful are the ones that don't even make you sick. So you're still out socializing and having sex and hugging people and doing all the feeling great and getting around. Those are the ones, those are the viruses, mutations that are going to, in a normal situation, quickly dominate the ecosystem. But what he also says is there are so many good therapeutic drugs out there right now that even if a pandemic did develop out of zoonosis, you could quickly treat it with therapeutic drugs. And he said that's why it's so important we start using synthetic biology. We'll never get a good bioweapon out of the wild. We need to start using synthetic. I mean, he literally says in that article, luckily, because it'll never happen naturally, but luckily, we now have these new synthetic biology techniques that allow us to get way ahead of nature and do things that nature would never produce. Oh, you know, it's a very interesting article. Nobody ever talks about it now, but it's you know, it's in my new Wuhan book, which you've read. And it's interesting because clearly they're not really worried about pandemics jumping from the wild. The place you look at all, you know, most of the modern pandemics, including Ebola and HIV and Lyme disease and all of these others. And, you know, there are very, very strong arguments for each one of them for lab origins. You know, we don't know, you know, this idea that even those epidemics came from the wild. We know there's not, you know, there an RSV, which is now epidemic. RSV came from a lab in Maryland, and that's very, very well documented, where they had, you know, they brought monkeys in to do vaccine experiments. The monkeys got RSV. They put the RSV monkeys with the other monkeys that didn't have it, and it spread. And then they put a lab worker in to see if they could jump to humans, and he got it. And now, you know, it's the biggest killer of children in the world. And it came from vaccine experiment in a Maryland, you know, military lab. So you start looking at where these diseases are coming from, and, you know, they're not jumping from the wild. There's not any good evidence that they jump from the wild with any, you know, regularity.
Right. Unless you take animals from the wild and put them in laboratories.
Yeah.
Right. And expose them to people. That's absolutely correct. All the flus, all the influenza pandemics come from farmed chickens or pigs and not from wild ones. So the whole concept, the whole idea that this pandemic planning and preparedness is built on is that we have to avoid spillover from wild animals. It's a false concept, but it has, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars have gone into supporting it and paying, you know, most of the virologists in the world. And so they're not going to tell they're not going to, you know, open their mouths and say this doesn't make any sense because they won't be funded. I want to say that in the 1918 flu, you know, we don't know for certain what happened because we can't necessarily believe what Fauci says. But Fauci did say that the people were dying from bacterial secondary pneumonias after they had a viral illness. And he and Jeffrey Taubenberger, who is basically, you know, one of his top people at NIAID, wrote that. And Taubenberger studied influenza for a very long time, but is equally as crafty, perhaps, as Fauci.
Anyway, I hesitate to even say this, but I read an article recently that is, you know, that said that also traced the etiology of that pandemic to a military base, a vaccine experiment in a military base in Kansas. I don't know if you saw that, but
I've seen, you know, over the years that story has come up too, that it was actually due to vaccines that were being used during World War I. But I think the problem is you get somebody like Fauci and they can fund so much fake science that like he's done for HIV and for COVID, you just don't know what's up because you've got all these conflicting stories and you don't know exactly what he paid for, what he did. You know, it's very difficult. I mean, it's an important reason to never allow a Fauci to fund anything again because, you know, they just absolutely destroy science.
Yeah, he destroyed science. And now people don't have any faith in science. And it's affected the whole issue of climate change and everything else. Nobody knows what to believe about anything anymore. And, you know, all these scientists are corruptible. And, you know, they're all dependent on these, on
grants.
Federal grant. It's exactly what Eisenhower warned about. Eisenhower, you know, he made his famous warning in that speech, his farewell speech, about the people remember about the military industrial complex, but the whole next part of his speech is about the federal scientific technocracy and how it would utterly corrupt science and corrupt our democracy and pervert, you know, all of public knowledge. And that was so prescient. I don't know why he knew that then, but he saw that coming. It was, you know, I have to look up who, you know, wrote that speech and what went into it. Yes. Because somebody was really smart who predicted that. Let's talk, you know, you had some other issues that you've been writing about recently that have been really interesting. You know, one of those, you've been writing a little bit about the COVID vaccine, and nobody really wants to talk a lot about that anymore. But, you know, some of your recent stuff is really interesting.
So as far as the COVID vaccine goes, the FDA just licensed a new version of COVID vaccine. And CDC rolled it out, approved it on Tuesday. So it's licensed for adults and kids age 12 and up, and EUA for children younger than that. Now, FDA had no business licensing it because it's a new product. But what they did was treat it like the flu shot. They grandfathered it in and made it for adults, you know, and those over 12, made it basically an amendment to the prior Comirnaty license, the one that you and I wrote about, that was never made available in the United States.
Well, let me just explain to people who are not experts in this area what you mean. Normally, when you have a new product, it has to go through testing. It has to go through, I mean, normally most new medical products would have to go through years of pre-licensure placebo-controlled trials that looked at all health outcomes. In other words, they looked at who took the product and whether they, you know, what their health condition, total health condition, autoimmune disease, neurological diseases, immunity to the target disease, et cetera, after a five-year period, and then do an assessment on that that assures that the people who take this drug are going to be healthier 5 years from now in all ways. That's what they're supposed to be doing. But with the flu vaccines basically created this precedent where they licensed the first one, got licensed after at least some process, but all subsequent ones, which are new products, are absolutely new vaccines that often have new ingredients in them and new, you know, all good. Everything's
right.
New
manufacturing platforms.
Manufacturing plants. But as long as you call it flu vaccine, it never has to be tested again. And so nobody has any clue whether they're efficacious. Nobody has any clue whether they're safe. at all, whether they save lives, we don't know. And in fact, the Cochrane Collaboration has done, which is the ultimate arbiter of pharmaceutical clinical trials, has said, yeah, they do not, there's no reduction in deaths from any of the flu vaccines, none. They're a complete waste of money. We're told and there are a series of studies, many, many studies that show if you take a flu vaccine, you're much more likely to get a non-flu infection than if you didn't take the vaccine. So the vaccine may protect you against that one variant, but you're more likely to get sick from other stuff because you've wrecked your immune system. And so, you know, and anybody who wants to read the, you know, kind of a summary of all the flu data, you go to the internet and look up Robert F. Kennedy Jr. letter to Sanjay Gupta, because I got angry one day and I went and did all the research on flu vaccine. I got every study. I looked them all and then I summarized them in a very neat, readable letter to Sanjay Gupta. But anyway, so now this is what they're doing with the COVID vaccine.
Yeah, so this is new. It's this method of sort of authorizing or approving a vaccine without data was only something that they were allowed to do for flu shots. But now the FDA has taken it upon itself to do that for COVID vaccines. And they are using data derived from the EU aid COVID vaccines, because of course in the United States, we didn't have any licensed COVID vaccines. This time we're supposed to get a licensed product because they're actually putting a price tag on it. So it's between $120 and $130 a dose, depending whether you get the Pfizer, Moderna, or the Novavax. And Novavax hasn't yet been licensed, but the other two were. But the government doesn't want any American to be left behind. They want everyone over 6 months to get this shot. So if insurance doesn't pay for it, the government is going to find a way. So they have a bridging program. So they'll manage to get you a free shot if you can't get it paid. Fortunately, for the last shot that didn't work, called the bivalent booster, only 17% of Americans, only one in six people took it. And this one nobody should take because there's no data at all. So for one manufacturer, they took some blood out of 50 people that they had given an injection to and said, well, antibodies were produced, you know, call it good. And for the other two, I think one used mice and one used monkeys. There is no safety or efficacy data really in humans on this new third version of the COVID vaccine. We know the spike is toxic. This, you're injecting a toxic substance into yourself. If you're taking an RNA shot, you may be making it forever. We don't know. There's plenty of evidence that people were continuing to produce the toxic spike protein 6 months, some people 6 months after they were injected. Something that has come up. Go ahead.
No, I read that study, I think it came out a couple of weeks ago, that said, yeah, they're finding the spike protein. So it's clearly being remanufactured by the cells.
Yes.
And it's toxic. It's like you've taught your cells to manufacture something that is poisoning you. And, you know, is causing all kinds of, and probably autoimmune disease, et cetera, because you're constantly overstimulating your immune system.
Yeah, with this one thing.
Vaccine is intended to permanently alter your immune system. So it's not a surprise that it does that. But this is terrifying because they said, first of all, they said it's going to stay in your arm. It's not going to move around your body. But now we know it goes into all of your organs. With women, it goes directly to the ovary and it concentrates there. It goes into your brain. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. You're putting toxic substances in your body. And now it appears that you're actually teaching your cells to manufacture that toxic substance, and they may not know how to stop.
And a recent other issue arose, which might explain why so many people are sick after these shots, and that is the presence of DNA plasmids, which initially were thought to be in the vaccine because of a cheap manufacturing process that didn't get rid of them. So the DNA plasmids from E. coli are used to manufacture the RNA in the vaccines. And the vaccines appear to be contaminated with at least 10 times more than should be residual in the vaccine. But then it also turned out that there are two proteins in the vaccine that were not disclosed on any labels, at least in the Pfizer vaccine, that come from the SV40 virus, simian virus 40, which is associated in some studies with several cancers. And, you know, came from, it contaminated polio vaccines. So 100 million Americans apparently got SV40 from polio vaccines, myself being one. You probably did also.
I did too.
So anyway,
SV40, meaning simian virus 40, it's a virus that came out of the monkeys. It was a virus that was in the substrate of monkey flesh and kidneys that they used to cultivate the vaccine. So they were cultivating the polio vaccines on a substrate on petri dishes that were made up of masticated monkey kidneys from green monkeys. And they started finding, this is before they knew how to find viruses, and they started finding viruses that were indigenous to monkeys. And people were worried, well, what will happen when you inject these into people? Because, you know, they've never been exposed. And SV40 was the 40th one they found. And what they found is that it's very, very carcinogenic. So if you inject it into guinea pigs or gerbils, they sprout tumors. And in fact, it's used in laboratories to develop tumors so that scientists can, you know, do work on tumor reduction. But our generation, the 98 million people, who American kids, you know, in the late 50s, early 60s, who got this. In fact, there was a very famous researcher at NIH named Bernice Eddy, who discovered this virus in the polio vaccine. And she warned NIH, this is a very dangerous virus that you're going to give to 100 million people. And she was their most famous scientist at the time. And they removed her telephone. They changed the locks on her lab. They locked her out of her lab. And they put her in a basement. And they ordered her not to talk to anybody. And then she released the study defiantly. And that's how we know about it. But our generation that got it has 10 times the soft tissue cancer of, you know, our parents' generation. And in many of these tumors, they have found SV40 virus. So, you know, it's very worrying. And now, you know, they're finding it in the COVID vaccines.
Right. Not the whole virus, but two proteins, but they're important proteins. These are proteins that, in conjunction with the DNA, double-stranded DNA that is in the plasmids, work to allow that DNA to get into the nucleus of your cells, where it can then relatively easily cause mutations. So the issue, you know, we worried before, well, maybe the RNA could be reverse transcribed into DNA and maybe that would get into the nucleus. But now we find that we're actually being injected with double-stranded DNA already with the keys that open the door to the nucleus. So it appears that, again, this was Pfizer vaccines, it appears that there is a much higher chance of mutation from the COVID shots, or at least the COVID shots that have been studied.
Any other bad news or good news, Meryl?
The UN is having a meeting on pandemic preparedness next Wednesday, and they have issued a 13-page booklet that they are using a silence procedure on, which means, you know, speak now, speak before the meeting, or forever hold your peace. And it will be presumably accepted. And there are many objectionable things in this document. I just sent you an email shortly before this took place. So let me pull some of that up. Here we go. So they do call for whole of government and health in all policies. They want our health systems to be digital, and they want the information on our health. They want our medical records shared. They do demand that nations have to obey. Basically, nations will be accountable for following the pandemic program that is being rolled out by these, you know, international agencies. They demand that misinformation and disinformation be censored, which requires, of course, the nations to perform surveillance of their citizens' social media. They demand the necessity of One Health. They demand more immunizations. They have created a role for philanthropic foundations like the Bill and Gates Foundation and Wellcome Trust, and for the private sector, and they call for new financing mechanisms to pay for all this pandemic preparedness. So what do they mean by that? There are other UN documents talk about the new financing that they want to roll out for the world. And believe it or not, policy brief number 6 that came out in May from the UN says that our current system of money is no longer fit for purpose. And so they're going to build a whole new financial architecture for us. Thank you very much. And in terms of pandemic preparedness, what they want is to make loans to nations that have not been able to pay them back in the past. So they want to expand the range of entities that can borrow. They want to loan a lot more money. They want very long periods of time during which these loans can be paid off. And then they demand monitoring. And as I said, accountability, which means nations have to spend this money on things that the WHO or the UN says they need to do for pandemics. There are so many problems with this idea because it will cause indebtedness of poor countries, making it much easier to sort of gain power over them, take them over or gain their resources like embassies, military bases, ports, airports, et cetera. But it also causes the whole healthcare system to be shifted into one that is constantly looking for pandemics rather than trying to provide good healthcare to people. And it also gets rid of privacy because if everybody's medical records go online so that we can learn more about disease, you know, privacy is ended. So that's just a few of the things that they're planning. What can I say? I think this is a world takeover by 1,000 cuts. It's coming in through alleged healthcare. And if it doesn't work through healthcare, it'll come in through CBDCs, control of food production, and things like that.
What should people do other than vote for me, which is clearly the solution to this problem, because I'll put this to bed overnight. What else can they do?
All right. So people should definitely vote for you because nobody else is talking about these things.
Going to be my, some big shot in government. I don't know what yet, but she's the one person who really knows what's going on. So we're going to talk about that. But go ahead and tell us what people...
All right. So we've got a bill in the House, H.R. 79. It's been co-sponsored by 51 Republicans, and it says get out of the WHO and defund the WHO. It takes a year to get out, but we can start by defunding them immediately. Surprisingly, the foreign assistance budget, the State Department budget, actually has zeroed out at the moment funding for the WHO. And also zeroed out funding for a $125 million program run by USAID to find pandemic pathogens around the world. So we want all our members of Congress to continue to zero out this funding. I think the plan was probably to change it at the last minute. And so you, our audience, need to tell your representative and senators no funding for finding pandemic pathogens, for none of this nonsense from the WHO and UN, and ask them to co-sponsor HR 79. Now, if the treaty, which has many names, it's called an accord, a convention, an other, and an instrument, if it does get voted on in favor by the WHO members, we want the Senate to be required to ratify it. It turns out that 80 to 90% of treaties are not ratified by the Senate. They're simply signed off on by the administration. We don't want that to happen with these two treaties. The IHR amendments basically are also a treaty, but because they're amendments, they're not being treated like a treaty. WHO does not want those to go through a formal ratification process, but we want that to happen as well. So there is a bill in the House and a bill in the Senate. I've forgotten their numbers. That demands that the treaty go through Senate ratification. That's also important. And start looking around at what is happening around you and see, for example, the regulatory system for approval of drugs and vaccines is being dismantled. So a bill is being put forth in the European Parliament to reduce regulation there. The UK has something like that. We don't have a bill doing that, but what we see is the FDA is doing that in front of our eyes, as is the CDC. We don't want to be subjected to drugs and vaccines that have not been properly tested or that have been fake tested, like the COVID vaccines, where they've lied to us about the tests. They've conducted a, you know, a Potemkin village of tests. We need real regulation. So we need to tell that to our Congress members, and we all have to be responsible for our own health now, because we can't trust the products that the federal agencies are, or the worldwide medical agencies, public health agencies, are putting in front of us. So we have to be very careful and use only products we can trust, if at all possible. And we need to get back real medicine again.
Oh, Meryl, I wish everybody in our country had a physician like you, and you know, we'd be a much healthier nation today, and we wouldn't be spending $4.3 trillion on healthcare. And I love you a lot. I'm very, very grateful for you, all the work you do to keep Americans informed about this, and how courageous you've been in resisting the pressure from the medical board in Maine. What is happening with your case right now?
So on Tuesday, we go back for the final hearing day and for closing arguments. But a month ago, my lawyers filed suit against the medical board. So now they actually, the members and the staff, realize there actually might be some consequences to them for the malicious prosecution they've done of me. They haven't, you know, they've made up various charges. They haven't substantiated anything. They have no evidence against me. I never have. But, you know, the board members and staff are henchmen. They're willing to do what they've been told. They've chosen a judge to hear my suit against the board, who has already ruled against free speech. He was recently overturned on appeal. So hopefully that put the fear of God into him, and maybe he'll rule fairly in my case. You know, we're hoping. But whatever it is, it's in God's hands, and I'm happy with that.
God bless you, Meryl, and thanks a lot for everything that you do. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.